Let's get started. I was debating summarizing last week's class quickly, but I'm gonna hold off on that. If anyone wants to talk more about it, if anyone wants to talk more about it, happy to do so after. But all of these classes in the four-part series they tug on specific questions. And tonight's gonna be the question of law and its interaction with Jews and the other. But in a bigger picture way, all of these classes deal with the tension that exists in Judaism between particularism and universalism, between the sense of a Jewish people that is linked to each other with a very close bond, and a connection to the world at large, beyond the Jewish people. And tonight we're going to see this kind of manifest itself in a different way, specifically with Jews and the laws of the other. So let's dig in. Everyone have a source sheet? Okay. Before we get started with the specifics about laws and courts in a very direct way, I want to just go back to the beginning, to Bereshit, at the beginning of, not all the way back to the beginning of time in Genesis, but to the first man-made catastrophe of the world, or at least, let's say the first societal catastrophe. Catastrophes start early on. We can't really make it past the first day of human creation without having some kind of minor disaster. But 10 generations from the creation of Adam and Eve it takes 10 generations from Adam and Eve to reach the generation of the flood and the major flood of Noah. And if you read in Bereshit chapters 8 and 9, I think a little bit earlier too, the Torah's explanation, or at least the Torah's precursor to the God deciding to flood the world, is V'ha'aretz malei chamas, that the land was filled with chamas. So different commentaries translate chamas differently. Rashi, I believe, translates it as theft, as stealing. But I think the best translation is lawlessness. The land was filled with lawlessness. Basically, there was a sort of chaos or anarchy that existed, and it led to a point in society where God decided to destroy the world. He couldn't, he felt the world was not worth keeping anymore. Because each person was just doing for their own best interests without keeping in mind the good of the other. And if you go now to source one, and sorry, I wrote the sources by hand because I forgot to do it when I printed. Source one takes us to the covenant that God makes between himself and Noah immediately after the flood. And we're going to start with source one and a conversation about the seven Noahide laws. Justin, would you like to start us off by reading source one?
Sure.
We'll talk about it, yeah.
Sure. God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fertile and increase and fill the earth."
Keep going.
Or,
take the source away.
Okay. Number two. The fear and the dread of you shall be upon all the beasts of the earth and upon all of the birds of the sky, everything with which the earth is astray, and upon all the fish of the sea, they are given into your hand. Every creature that lives shall be yours to eat, as well as the green grasses. I give you all these. Four, you must not, however, eat flesh with its lifeblood in it, but for your own lifeblood I will require a reckoning. I will require it of every beast, of man too. Will I require a reckoning for human life, of every man, for that of his fellow man? Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for in his image did God make man.
Okay. So this is the covenant that God makes between himself and Noah and Noah's descendants. And out of this covenant, our rabbinic tradition derives the Shiva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, the seven Noahide laws that are obligatory upon all humanity, Jew and Gentile. And out of these seven Noahide laws, one that we're going to talk about today, last time we spoke about some of the food-related laws, but specifically for us today is, and you can find it in the list of the seven Noahide laws, is an obligation to establish courts of justice. That's the rabbinic interpretation of this covenant between God and man. And so you could actually read the beginning of Bereshit as a breakdown in law and then a decision to restart the world from its scratch, from all the way back, raising it down to the foundation, rebuilding the law with Noah and his descendants. And the first thing that God decides to decree upon Noah and his descendants is establish for yourselves Bate Din, courts of law. Where does this come from in the text itself? If I were asking you to play Chazal for a minute, anyone want to look back at source one and see where we get this from? This is unfair. Yeah.
Yeah, I would go with
that's right, Jeff.
Yeah, whoever sheds blood, men by the blood shall be shed. So you might be in court to determine like how you're going to do that.
Yeah. So already, it's in source six already that Rashi quotes a whole Talmudic debate about how do you decide if someone is actually guilty of shedding blood in a pre-biblical era, or in a pre-Sinai era where we don't have the exact laws of witnesses. How do you decide who's liable for shedding blood? So there seems to be some kind of process of justice already built into the Torah, and I think that's where Chazal get this law within the seven Noahide laws of establishing courts of law or courts of justice. Yeah.
I will require a reckoning.
Uh-huh.
That seems like the beginning of justice.
Yeah. Edrosh miad kochaya. The Hebrew language there is that is a doubling of the verb edrosh and edrashenu, which means I will seek out. And I think the translation here is I will require reckoning. Maybe. It sounds there that the axe is more on God. And the truth is, I actually didn't have time to look this up at the Talmud itself. This is just my best guess that it's from verse 6, but maybe it's from verse 5 too.
So the Noahide law explicitly stated in Genesis, because that one's looked for then explicitly as this list, and I never found it.
Yeah, great question. So some of them aren't. Not having a limb off a live animal is explicit in these verses, I think.
Yeah.
Not killing, that's also explicit. God says, if you try, as Jonah just pointed out, whoever sheds the blood of mine, by man his blood shall be shed. They're not all explicit, right? Not stealing, I don't think is absolutely explicit in here. Not cursing God, I think, isn't explicit as well. Okay.
That's interesting because I think this week's parsha we talked about Dina and how she was raped by Shechem.
Yeah.
And why was it that that her brothers killed everybody in Shechem, and why was there that collective punishment? And I think some of the commentators point back that there was no course of justice.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the reason why everybody was, during the circumcision, they were all killed.
Yeah, it's hard.
There's some connection.
Yaakov doesn't have an easy time justifying what his sons did, but I hear you. There's something there. Yes, and then we're going to kind of pick this up and see how it carries itself throughout the Torah. Steve?
Very quickly.
Birthday boy.
Your answer in Kirsten's comment, verse 6 follows so closely from verse 5.
Yeah.
Logically, it's simply an extension.
Okay. So God's going to be upset about it, and then whoever sheds the blood, there's going to be a consequence of that action.
Yes.
Okay. If this is kind of the beginning of law in society, when it gets to the time that the Jewish people are formed, one of the first things that happens after we leave Egypt is, even before Mount Sinai, Moses gets a visit from his father-in-law, which is always an intimidating moment. And what does Yitro tell Moshe? Well, Yitro basically asks, like, let me follow you around for the day. And Moshe tells him, basically, I don't have time to spend with you. From morning to night, I'm answering all of the legal questions of every single person who's just left Egypt. And the first thing Yitro tells him is, this is not going to work out for you. You need to basically create a system of judges, right, where there should be judges for the tens and the fifties and the hundreds and the thousands, and only the questions that can't make it past this hierarchy of judges should go to you, and you'll be the ultimate decisor of law and about arguments, disagreements, fights between different Jews in this camp. And so it seems to be like the first response of Yitro, who is probably worth saying not part of the Jewish people in this moment, that he tells Moshe is, you're a fledgling nation. You've just left Egypt. You're not going to survive if you don't have some kind of legal system that doesn't just rely on you. Right? One person is not alone. And from that point on, if you go carry your way through the Torah, we have the Parsha of Shoftim, which the opening verse is, you should have judges and enforcers. Right? We have Tzedek, Tzedek, Tirdof, justice, justice, you shall pursue. Yeah, Pam.
So, but I think that that's rejected. That whole idea is rejected, is it not? Because Moshe is, you know, while Moshe is on earth, we should be going to Moshe, not this this group of judges. Isn't that not what
so
happens later?
When Moshe is alive, he's the ultimate, he's the final decisor. He's the Supreme Court.
Because I'm a bureaucrat, and when I read this little section about having, you know, like an organized way of handling things, I was like, yeah, that's right. And then I was shocked to discover that it was not right. It was, you know, we should be talking to Moses directly while he's around
yeah.
to talk to, as opposed to disseminating this role to others.
So I think there are statements about not deciding law if you're in front of Moshe. Like, if you're in front of the greatest judge of the generation, you shouldn't make legal decisions in their presence. You should kind of defer to their judgment. But it does say that Moshe couldn't be everywhere at once, and so he accepted Yitro's advice, if I understood correctly.
Because I remember I was just really shocked that it was not accepted. I thought it was like, this is a bad idea. And I was
yeah.
really shocked that they thought it was a bad idea.
So it's chapter 18 in
okay.
Shemot in Exodus. Let me know if I'm wrong.
Okay. I remember it being shocked.
Okay. One of the images that I think is most powerful in Chumash is that Moses doesn't go up Mount Sinai entirely alone. Moshe makes it to the top on his own. And the nation, the mass nation, has to stay beneath the boundary of the mountain. But some people, a select few, are able to make it partway up the mountain. And those are the 70 elders. Aaron, who represents kind of the priesthood and the religious community, and then the 70 elders who represent what becomes known as the Sanhedrin, or the High Court, and the legal community. And so as part of Moshe kind of going up to receive the Torah to create this covenant between God and the Jewish people, it's almost as if he's being supported by the legal system, or the representatives, the judges of the legal system, who are standing halfway up between Moshe and God on one hand and the nation on the other hand. And I just thought that was a really fitting image for kind of the importance that Judaism places on law.
But they didn't stay up there waiting for him.
They came back down.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they make it closer than anyone else.
Yeah.
So here's where the tension kind of begins. So I think it's clear from the Torah, at least from our interpretation of the Torah in traditional Judaism, that law is something that is almost like either an ideal or a necessary evil for which humanity, which is a precondition of humanity's continued existence. There, I guess you could look at Noah and his relationship with, and God's relationship with law in two different ways. But by the time Jews get their own laws, to what degree do we keep it to ourselves, or do we defer to the laws of the societies in which we live? And that's kind of what I wanted to zoom in for the rest of the time today. And we're going to see two different, like last time, where there's kind of two different currents, we're going to see two different directions within our halachic tradition, within the Talmud. And I think, again, like last time, that's an intentional that's an intentional tension that's being created. And I wanted to kind of explore this for now. So part one for today, which is under the section of foreign courts, this is going from sources 3 through 7, is an assumption that when two Jews have a legal case against each other, and for now we'll keep it simple, we're just talking about monetary disputes. When there's a monetary dispute between two Jews, the Talmud assumes that there's a Torah prohibition of going to non-Jewish court. And so the term that's used throughout the Talmud is arkaot, our Babylonian courts, or non-Jewish courts, and the Talmud assumes that there's actually a prohibition of going there. So I want to explore this prohibition, and we'll first learn the sources that make it explicit. We'll try to understand where it comes from, how the rabbis of the Talmud derived it from even the words of the Torah itself. I want to then kind of broaden it and express a challenge within that idea. And then before we get to the end of the section, talk together, just have a short discussion. Why is this a value? Like, why does it matter? Okay, so let's get started. First up in source 3, Steve, you're the birthday boy, so I'll save source 4 for you because that's a little bit more meaty. Source 3, I'll read for myself for now, is the beginning of Parshat Mishpatim. Mishpatim is the portion in the Torah that has the most mitzvot, the most obligations or laws. And the opening words are Ve'ele HaMishpatim Asher Tasim Lifnehem. These are the ordinances that you shall place before them. Who's the them here?
The people.
So God speaking to Moses and says, Moshe, put it before them, the people. That's definitely the simple interpretation of the verse. The Talmud, though, is going to take that which is really not necessary. Right? You didn't have to write that in the Torah for the simple reading itself. And the Talmud's going to say, there's something else going on in that one word of Lifnehem, in front of them. And so that's what we're going to pick up with in source 4. Before I ask Steve to read it, I'm going to give you a little bit of background. So we're going to find a great Babylonian rabbi, an Amora. He's a rabbi of the times of the Talmud, post-Mishnah. So the times of the Amoraim is the Amoraic period in Babylon lasts from about 200 to 500, maybe 550, 600. And Abaye is one of the most important Amoraim. And Rav Yosef lived among him. So these are two rabbis. And the background of the case is that they are great rabbis, but their rabbinic status is considered lower than rabbis living in Israel. Anyone know what might be a difference between a rabbi living in Israel 1,500 years ago and a rabbi living in Babylon 1,500 years ago? And we'll go kind of into contemporary language. When a rabbi today finishes rabbinical school, they get a document, and sometimes it's handwritten by a sofer or by a scribe, and that document is called smicha. You may have heard the term. So the document is known as smicha. What does smicha actually mean in Hebrew? It comes from the word lismoch or samach, which means to place down. And the tradition that this is based on is that our tradition is back to Moses. Each teacher would, when they're ready to kind of convey, or when they're ready to pass on the authority of the tradition to their students, they would put their hands on their head and kind of press down upon their head, and they would give them smicha, and they would kind of convey, or they would pass down that authority. Smicha also is related to animal offerings, because the other time you see the word smicha in the Torah is when a person puts their hands down on a sin offering to say that I know that my life is really, in theory, on the line because I did something wrong, but God, I'm hoping that symbolically you accept this animal in my stead. So there's smicha there too. Smicha means placing down. Smicha could only function in the land of Israel. It has this metaphysical status, and the holiness of the land of Israel was a requirement to pass down smicha. So that's kind of the background context here, that you have these rabbis, and they're trying to do rabbi things, but they don't have smicha because they don't live in Israel. So that's the background for this case in the Gemara, which is in from Masechet Gittin. It's the tractate that talks about divorce. And that's
because at that time, Israel was still independent.
In 300 to 500, Israel had fallen first during the years leading up to the destruction of the temple.
So this is...
So Israel had fallen to the Romans.
So Eve... Because the first time the Romans came into the land, there was sort of still the semblance of independence.
Yeah, it was kind of like a vassal kingdom.
But you're saying at this point, even though the independence of the people in Israel was gone, that the Romans were absolute mastery.
Yeah.
That the people in Babylonia didn't have the right to.
So they assumed, I don't know what age smicha ended entirely, because it doesn't exist anymore. So the smicha that we give out nowadays is honorary, but it's not the official smicha, which is why, parenthetically, we can't create a Sanhedrin. We can't create another great rabbinical court, or most people assume we can't, because we don't have the tradition of smicha anymore. So at that, we're talking about the years, let's say, 200 on, which is the Amoraic period, the period of the Talmud in Babylon. There was no more independence of any sort after the Bar Kokhba revolt in Israel in 136. However, there were still groups of rabbis who lived there, mostly in the north, in northern Israel, and they still kept on the tradition of smicha in the land of Israel itself. The assumption was, and I don't know exactly why, but smicha can only be passed down in the land of Israel, even with or without independence.
Okay, so
that
part didn't matter. Yeah. Take a trip to northern Israel and come back.
Yeah, there are stories of rabbis having traveled to Israel. It happens all the time in the Talmud. I love the term is, the term in the Babylonian Talmud is when you're going on a trip, you're going Marava, you're going westward. Because if you're living in Iraq or Iran and you want to take a trip to Israel, we always think that Israel's in the east. But that's just based on where the majority of Jews have lived for the past 2,000 years. But if you're living in Iraq or Iran, when you want to go to Israel, you're going westward. So we know that there's a lot of traveling. I don't know if smicha was passed on. There's definitely a lot of competition between the Babylonian rabbis and the Israeli rabbis until Israel's rabbinic community is crushed in like the 400s, and then it doesn't really matter anymore. So that's for another time. Steve, you want to take it away?
Surely. Talmud Bavli, Masechet Gitlin, 88p. Abaye found Rav Yosef sitting in court as the judge and compelling husbands to give their wives bills of divorce.
Compelling here, in some context, might even mean with, forcing them, possibly even with acts of violence. But we'll get there another time. This is the rabbinic way to avoid the Aguna crisis. The Aguna crisis is chained women who are no longer living in a married state, but have not received their get, their halachic divorces. So back in the day, you would be allowed, if there's a certain amount of rabbinic authority or autonomy, you'd be allowed to basically force it out of the husband. Okay, that's for another time. But Abaye sees Rav Yosef forcing husbands to give gets to their wives, and he says to him,
"But aren't we ordinary people, not ordained judges? And it is taught in a Bereda that Rabbi Tarfon would say, with regard to any place where you find Gentile courts, a goriot, and even if their laws are like Jewish laws, you may not attend them. As it is stated, now these are the ordinances which you shall set before them. It is derived from here that one may go to court only before them, i.e. Jewish judges, and not before Gentiles. Alternatively, it is derived that one may go to court before them, i.e. ordained judges, and not before ordinary people. Since we are not ordained judges, how can you perform a distinctly judicial act?"
Okay, so I'll ask you to pause there for a second. When Abaye saw Rav Yosef acting like a rabbinic judge, he had an initial question, and it was based on his knowledge of an earlier text. A Braita is a text from the period of the Mishnah. So he's saying, how could you be doing this? We know that there's a statement from earlier that doesn't allow it for one of two reasons. The Braita says, going back to the verse in Exodus of Mishpatim, these are the laws that you shall place lifnehem, in front of them. In front of them is a limitation. Only some people can be judges. Not everyone can be judges. There's two interpretations of who are the some people. And interpretation number one is Jewish courts and not Gentile courts. And interpretation number two is even within Jewish courts, only Jewish courts that have smicha judges, that have the real rabbinic judges, but not us fake rabbis living in Babylon. We're not going to go further in this source just for the sake of time. The ending of the source is the concept of shlichut. Shlichut is an emissary. If anyone knows a Lubavitch rabbi, they'll call themselves a shaliach. They're shlichim. And they call themselves shaliachs because they're the emissaries of the Lubavitch Rebbe. They're emissaries of the 7th Rebbe who died in the 90s. So shlichut basically means we are being the messengers, or we are empowered by the rabbis in Israel to do their work here in Babylon. Okay, it's somewhat of a technical reason. But what emerges from this source, and we actually, this is the law in Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law and in Maimonides, is that Jews should not go to Gentile courts to resolve at least monetary disputes. So let's take that to source 5 on the top of the next page. And what you should notice is that the Rambam takes this statement, or this Braita in the Talmud, the Rambam takes the Braita in the Talmud, and I think he makes it more personal. The language he chooses is personal language. So, Kirsten, would you read source 5 for us?
"Whoever submits a suit for adjudication to non-Jewish judges is a wicked man. It is as though he reviled, blasphemed, and rebelled against the Torah of Moshe."
Okay. The Braita wasn't so angry about this. Right? The Braita said, you shouldn't go to non-Jewish courts. Right? But Maimonides, and eventually the Shulchan Aruch Rabbi Yosef Cairo afterwards, says that someone who goes to a non-Jewish court is a Rasha, is an evil person. Where did that come from? Why that personalization or that really almost hatred of someone going to a non-Jewish court?
Because, like, historically, the non-Jewish laws of the land have been used to persecute the Jews many times.
Yeah. So they've often hurt Jews.
Built into their justice system.
Uh-huh.
Justice system to persecute Jews.
Yeah. Interesting. I'm thinking about Rambam, Maimonides. He lived in an Arabic society, and Jews may have had the status of dhimmi, which is, like, I guess, a quasi, like, some, given some rights but not all rights. Interesting. Okay. Anyone else?
Well,
thanks, Claire. Yeah.
You're having other people, you're bringing other people into serving a family there.
Mm-hmm. You're bringing some people. This is something that should be done, like, internally. And if you're taking it outside of the Jewish community, it's like you're airing our dirty laundry.
Well, you're just involving people that don't need to be involved.
Uh-huh.
Which weakens the community.
Okay. So we should function as this strong, tight-knit internal community, and it's weakened when we go outside of our own to figure out our disputes.
Yeah,
okay.
It's almost the analogy of having the Jewish people having themselves as a state within whatever nation they happen to be in.
Yeah. And we actually know historically, and I'm not the biggest expert of medieval Jewish history in Europe, but for most of Jewish history, we had some form of autonomy. Even if we were being taxed heavily, Jews often were given the right to set laws and to police their own community. So that definitely exists. The other thing that I think is going on here, and once I'll say it, it might even become obvious in the language of the Rambam, is if you are a Jew and you choose to go to a non-Jewish court, it's kind of like a slap in the face for the Torah. Not kind of, it is. If you're a Jew and there's an entire section of the Code of Jewish Law and like an entire section of the Mishnah and the Talmud that talk about what to do, what the Jewish law is for when one ox gores another ox, or when you fall into someone's a hole in someone else's field and you break your leg. There's all of these areas of law that are part of our Torah. We've been teaching our school children these Mishnahs and these sections in the Talmud for thousands of years. And you don't care about that? You're just going to go to the civil court? Right? That's a slap in the face of the Torah. And I think you can actually read that into Rambam and Maimonides. That's the second. It's the second line. It is as though he reviled, blasphemed, and rebelled against the Torah of Moshe. Right? Nothing against other people's laws, but we have something good for ourselves. This is our Torah. This is our tradition. How could you slap that tradition in the face by choosing to go elsewhere? And it's considered to be a rebellion against the Torah. However, here's an exception, because like every good law, there's an exception. If the reasoning behind the law is that if you go to a non-Jewish court, it's as if you're slapping the Torah in the face, an exception or a way out of that is if you try really hard, but it's not good enough. Right? For example, there's two litigants, they're both Jewish, and one of them really, really wants to go to rabbinic court, and the other one absolutely refuses. So what do you do in that circumstance? So there's actually there's a procedure that's happened, and you can read it for yourselves later in source 6 in the Code of Jewish Law, I'm not going to read it for now, called a heter arkaot, where you get a rabbinic dispensation to go to a non-Jewish court. And you basically go to the court and you say, I've done my best to come and have this case adjudicated by a Beit Din. But the other person's not letting me. They're absolutely refusing. And if you've shown that you really want to honor the Torah's law, it's just not possible under these circumstances, then there is actually a way out where the rabbinic court says, we understand that this is your kind of present-day reality, and therefore you can go and have your case tried in a civil court. Okay.
Question?
Yeah.
I mean, would that also be true if two Jews were adversaries and both to go to the Beit Din, but the secular law in the country where they lived compelled them to go to a secular court?
Great. I don't have an official answer for that question because it has never been presented to me. I mean, Canada and America allow for personal arbitration or civil arbitration, and any Western society that allows for arbitration will allow a Beitin to act as the arbitrating body. So it doesn't actually come up so much nowadays. But the interesting question is, to what degree do we accept the dominance of civil law, or let's say Western American law, you know, plug in your country of choice. And we'll get to there. We'll get there a little bit later. Yes, Sid?
Whatever party, they both agree to Jewish arbitration, but then after the decision, one doesn't like the decision, so they go to the civil court. What's the...
Yeah. So there's... what if they reject the premise of... So modern Beitins, modern courts, and by the way, you should view tonight's class as just a plug for this scholar-in-residence that we have this weekend with Rabbi Yonah Reis, who runs one of the most prominent Beit Din's rabbinic courts in the country, deals with these kinds of cases all the time. You normally sign an agreement before you go to Beit Din nowadays that accepts the ruling of the Beit Din, and so you're kind of signing all your rights to go to a court afterwards. There's legalese terms for all these things. In 2017, living in America, I think the most fascinating parts of functioning as the head of a Beit Din is that you need to know civil law really, really well in order to make sure that the decisions of a Beit Din will be respected by the broader court system.
And negotiation, in the same case, you have now a corporation requiring that if you take their service, you have to agree to binding arbitration within the organization.
I think so, but ask Rabbi Reis, because he's the expert. Rabbi Reis, in addition to having studied, I think, 8 years after his smicha to become a rabbinic judge, also finished Yale Law and was the head of the law review. So he kind of brings these two worlds together, which is really important nowadays. And it's a really good question for him, but I don't have a great answer. I'll tell you one other area, though, where Rabbi Howard Jachter, who's a contemporary rabbi, lives in Teaneck, New Jersey, pointed out that there's another piece to this question of why do Jews prefer, or why do Jews reject civil law as opposed to rabbinic law in these kinds of cases, is because built into the Beit Din process, built into the process of din, which is straight up justice, is a quasi-legal term of going lifnim mishur hadin, going beyond the letter of the law. There's basically, within the halachic system of Beit Din, very strong attempts that the courts make to have people just go based on pshara, which is a compromise position, basically non-legal arbitration. It's binding arbitration, but they first try to have both parties just compromise with each other. There's another word for that. Mediation. And it's actually explicit in Shulchan Aruch that every rabbinic court is obligated before they actually start the din, the judgment proceedings, to first have the parties try to come to a compromise on their own and to try to mediate a compromise between the two parts. I quoted some texts that I thought were quite beautiful that kind of speak to this idea. Rabbi Jachter quoted Rav Soloveitchik as saying that halacha, which is, let's say, in these kinds of disputes, is like the absolute law. Halacha is not a ceiling but a floor, kind of as being a motivating principle. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, who passed away 2 years ago, wrote in his book Leaves of Faith, traditional halachic Judaism demands of the Jew both adherence to halacha and commitment to an ethical moment that, though different than from halacha, is nevertheless of a piece with it, and in its own way fully imperative. So that there's an ethic that's built in actually to the Beit Din system. Hopefully there's an ethic built into the Beit Din system that I don't think in any civil law, certainly not back in the times of Talmud, and I think even today, what courts are trying to decide is the letter of the law. And a Beit Din, in addition to that, will first try to come to a spirit of the law compromise position between the two. You can actually see this, once again, read this for yourself later. There's a debate about how to read one of the most famous verses in the Torah, which is Tzedek, Tzedek, Tirdof. Justice, justice, you shall pursue. The rabbis of the Talmud ask, just say justice. Why do you have to say justice, justice? And which is like a fair question. Why does that have to repeat itself twice? And the opinion that we actually follow by legally is that there's two forms of tzedek, two forms of justice. One is absolute law, and the other is pshara, is compromise. That you have two parallel tracks to reaching a form of justice. Right? There's the absolute line letter of the law, and then there's the lifnim mishurat hadin that goes beyond the letter of the law. So that's another piece in this puzzle of why it's why traditional Judaism really pushes for Beit Din adjudication and against civil courts. I think there's something beautiful to that going beyond the letter of the law. But when you're looking at the Rambam, I think his primary reason is to not go within our Torah system is a slap to the Torah system. That's part one. As we say on Sukkot, at Simchas Torah, Ad Kana Kaf Aleph. Till now, we just finished the first circuit, and let's go to circuit two. Okay, circuit two is the concept that if you don't take out any other Hebrew or Hebrew Aramaic words today, the term to remember is Dina de Malchuta Dina. Dina is the Aramaic for Din, or the law, of the Malchut, of the kingdom, is Din, is the law. The law of the land is the law. Mm. So this is, we started with kind of part one, which is the particularity around Jews and the laws of the other. We want to keep it internal, right? We want to keep it within the Jewish system as much as possible. There's a built-in recognition in the Talmud, and what's really interesting is that the rabbis' post-Talmud debate, is this only rabbinic in nature, or is it even biblical in nature? There's a understanding that we are obligated to look to, sometimes, to civil law as law and binding upon us. So where does this come from? Okay, this comes from a context, and once again, I'm going to kind of try to keep things short. You have these sources for yourselves to look at in more detail later. The Mishnah in Nedarim in source 8, if you look at source 8 just for now, we're not going to read the first half of it, but we're going to start, the first half starts with the Mishnah, which is authored in 200, and then the Babylonian Talmud, where you see Gemara, picks up on it, and that's written in the 200-300 years afterwards. So the Mishnah starts by talking about when are you allowed to transgress the Torah law about not taking oaths or not swearing falsely, right? Not swearing falsely is a big deal. It's one of the Ten Commandments. But the Mishnah gives you a number of exceptions. When is it permitted to swear falsely? And one of them is you can swear falsely if you think you're talking to a murderer. If a murderer or someone you suspect has killed and may want to kill you too, you're allowed to lie to them. You can even use God's name to lie to them. You can swear in the name of God. The next is robbers. And without making any judgment calls about the current system, immediately after robbers is tax collectors. You can break the Torah's, one of the Ten Commandments, and lie to tax collectors. Okay. Don't stop now. Everyone has to stay for the next 10 minutes. Don't ever go, please, around saying Rabbi Albert says that we're allowed to cheat on our taxes. That's not the takeaway of this discussion. Okay. I'm Canadian. I don't even get to vote and I pay my taxes. Okay. So if you just read the Mishnah saying you are allowed to lie when it comes to your taxes, and I just told you that there's a general rabbinic principle, which is Dina de Malchuta Dina, the law of the land is the law, then what is the next logical question?
When?
When is the law of the land the law of the land?
No. When is it appropriate to lie to the tax collector?
Right. Yeah. Under what circumstances is it appropriate? And that's basically, that is exactly what the Gemara picks up saying. Kirsten, you just read. So Don, can you pick it up from halfway through source 8, right after the word Gemara right after the word Gemara? Oh,
okay. But didn't Shmuel say the law of the kingdom is the law, i.e. there's a halakhic principle that Jews must obey the laws of the state in which they live? Since one must pay the tax determined by the kingdom, how did the sages permit one to lie in order to avoid paying? Rav Hinana said that Rav Kahana said that Shmuel said the Mishnah is referring to a tax collector who has no fixed amount for collection established by the kingdom, but rather collects the tax arbitrarily. Therefore, this case is not included in the law of the kingdom. A sage of the school of Rabbi Yonah said, the Mishnah is referring to a tax collector who establishes himself as such independently and was not appointed by the kingdom.
Okay. So don't get your hopes up about evading taxes this year. That's basically what the Gemara is saying. Because this Mishnah is only talking about one of two circumstances, which are one, that you have someone going around, maybe even on behalf of the government. And here we're not talking about governments like democracies today. We're talking about a king who appoints a tax collector. But this tax collector is going around and saying, this person, like, I like their smile. They'll pay 10%. But that person, I don't know, they give me a smirk on their way out of the house. I'll take 25% from them. So exception number one is if there's an arbitrary system for taxing, right, that is not equitable for every person, then you're allowed to not pay the taxes. So taxes are only binding if they're on some level equitable. That's example number one. Example number two is taxes are only binding if they're actually being collected by the ruling body of that area. You can't just have someone, you can't have, I don't know, a gang going and collecting on their turf. They have to be the recognized authority or the recognized government overseeing a territory of land. And only once you get to that point are you obligated to pay your taxes, and are you not, therefore, allowed to swear in God's name to evade them. Okay. So...
Did Shmuel live in Israel or Babylon?
So Shmuel, there's actually two Shmuels in the times of the Talmud. There's a we're going to get to another Shmuel, who's the prophet Samuel, who lived in Israel before the first temple era, right? You know, in the few hundred years after the Jews made it in. I think Shmuel lived in Babylon, and the reason is, I'm not an expert, that apparently it's like historically significant when Shmuel made this statement. It was in an era where there had been kind of a wave of positive relations between the controlling government in Babylon and the Jewish community. So he was kind of, there was a wave of basically saying, and this is quite, I think, clear to your point before, that there used to be an era where we were not being treated nicely and we were discriminated against in a very very strong way. But now that things are getting better, we should recognize that we're, you know, we're in this together with the society around us.
The Roman Empire had notoriously tax collectors who were arbitrary.
Oh, interesting. Okay. I'm pretty sure he was Babylonian, so is the short answer to your question. There was an article in Jewish, there's a website, the Jewish Library, something online. If I remember, if you remind me after, I'll try to send you the article that has a thought about when this happened historically and what was going on in Babylon at the time. But I didn't get into the details of it. Yeah. Well, Babylon was separate. It doesn't mean that they were always being treated nicely. Yeah. So that's what the Talmud is saying here, that the law of the land is the law of land unless the tax collector is not being fair and basically just using his own his or her own judgment to arbitrarily tax people at different levels. That's the first point in the Gemara here. So when is the law of the land the law of the land? I guess that was kind of Bill's question, is when it's fair and when it's representing the monarch or the governmental body, as opposed to just some like random person going out and taxing you because they have a gun in their hands.
What does truma mean?
What does truma mean? Truma are... Does that come up in this?
It says that the produce... Oh,
yeah.
Is truma, though it is not
truma. Okay, great. Good. Truma is a food that is dedicated to either the Levites or the Kohanim or the priests. And it has a status of holy food, such that if you're not a Levi or a Kohen, you're not allowed to eat it. And so that's one way to avoid giving these fruits by saying, like, sorry, you're not the Levi, you're not the Levite, you're not allowed to eat these. So truma is for a Kohen. Okay, so that's where we start to see Dina de Malchut de Dina. If you want to read later, Rabbi Herschel Schachter wrote a very important article on this topic. You can find it online later if you search Rabbi Herschel Schachter and Dina de Malchut de Dina. And I quoted a little bit of it before. He quotes a great comment from the Magen Mishnah, who's a commentary on the Rambam, on Maimonides, who says that the very language that Shmuel uses for this principle is dina de malchut dina. When the law of the land is law, it's just, when it's din, then it applies. But not gezel de malchut dina, not thievery from the state is law. That when it comes to tax collecting, it has to be some kind of equitable tax collecting that falls on everyone. I thought that was a nice kind of framing of it. And you can read that more in source 9 for yourselves later. Where does this come from, this law? We never have enough time. So I'm gonna start sharing things without referring to the sources themselves. Okay, there's a few different opinions that I found as to where this law is derived from, because Shmuel is pulling this out of thin air. He's not quoting a verse in the Torah or in the Bible to support himself. So one opinion is that the authority that's given to a kingdom, or maybe to a government, a non-monarchic government, comes actually from the power that God gives to kings. Okay, so let's back it up. The Torah tells us that there's an obligation to give a king, and when it comes to the time when the Jewish people want a king for themselves, we're now going from one Shmuel to another Shmuel, not the Shmuel of the Talmud who says that the law of the land is the law, but this is the Shmuel in Samuel 1, 1 Samuel, who is the prophet of the Jewish people, and they all come up to him in the days right after the days of the Shoftim, the judges in the books of prophets, and they say, give us a king so that we can be like all the other nations, which parenthetical, is that the right reason to want a king? Maybe, maybe not. Lots of text has been written about this, whether monarchy is considered a divine ideal or just a necessary evil in itself. Save that for another time. And Shmuel basically quotes God as saying, you want a king? I'll show you a king. And the verses in chapter 8 of 1 Samuel of Shmuel Aleph basically say, this is what you want, and so this is what you're going to get. But here's all the stuff you're now going to have to deal with because you wanted a king. And one of the things is, he's going to take a tenth of your produce and a tenth of your animals and basically tax you. He'll force you to do labor for him. You'll have to spend part of your year working to make palaces for the king. It's not going to be all the fun and games you thought it would be. And if you take that idea in Shmuel Aleph and then read source 11 in the Babylonian Talmud Sanhedrin, Jonah, I think you're up. So just read the first two lines in source 11.
It's taught in her birth to Rabbi Yossi, says, concerning all the actions that are stated in the biblical passage about the king, it is permitted for a king to perform them.
Okay, so the biblical passage of the king, the Hebrew there is Parshat Melech, the passage that talks about the king. That's a reference to the 8th chapter of Shmuel Aleph. If you want to read it for yourselves later, it's a source above. And he basically says, whatever God says to the Jewish people that they're going to have to deal with once they get a king, the king is allowed to enact that. And this is debated in the Talmud. The next opinion says that it's really not the right of the king. It's just there to scare the people, to treat them a little, like to teach them subservience to a monarchy. But okay, we actually accept that opinion. Now here's the big stretch here. But this is the assumption of many of our rabbis, such as the Vilna Gaon, is that this not only applies to a Jewish king, but even applies to a non-Jewish king or a non-Jewish government. That there is a right that is given by God in this moment to a non-Jewish government or a Jewish government to tax the people. And from there, the context in which we find the law from the later Shmuel of the Talmud, that the law of the land is the law, is specifically in the context of taxation, right? You're allowed, a king or a government is allowed to tax their people, and the people are obligated to listen to the law of the king. Two other assumptions for why this might be the case. No, we don't have time for it, sorry. We'll just go with that one for now. When does the principle of Dina de Malchuta Dina apply in contemporary times? So we mentioned already, it applies to taxes, when they're fair and equally beneficial and applicable to all, not just kind of selective picking. The Talmud talks about setting currencies, like the valuation of money is actually something that Jews are obligated to listen to the law of the land for. It doesn't apply, and this is explicit in the Talmud, when there's a contradiction between Jewish law and non-Jewish law. For example, if the law of the land tells you that everyone is obligated to work on Shabbat, we don't follow the law of the land, and halacha would still say you have to not work on Shabbat. It can be challenging, but you know that's not an exception. That's not where we apply Dina de Malchuta Dina. One really interesting place where it does apply is when it comes to the punishment of criminals. So we didn't get into this earlier, but already in the first statement from the Talmud we read, there's an assumption that certainly outside of Israel, But even in an era after the destruction of the temple, that rabbinic courts could not fully adjudicate criminal cases. They didn't have the authority to offer corporal punishment, to offer kind of the higher degree punishments that are generally assumed to be required to enforce those laws properly. And so from early on, we actually see that rabbis are willing to rely on dina de malchut dina, the law of the land, to adjudicate criminal cases. So even though we said that there's a prohibition of going to a non-Jewish authority when it comes to monetary law, when it comes to monetary cases, in areas where we don't have the power to bring a person to justice on our own, there's actually maybe even an obligation to bring it to non-Jewish courts. Okay, I'm going to have to continue outside for the rest of the class. Here's where it gets complicated. The Talmud has a prohibition that is called Mesira. Mesira becomes especially well-known in the Middle Ages in Europe when the Yiddish version of that becomes a Meiser. A Meiser is someone who turns over Jews to the government. And it becomes like the worst thing you could call someone in medieval Europe is to be called a Meiser. It's like you're I don't even know what a good way to describe it is.
Traitor?
You're a traitor to the Jewish people. And there's actually a prohibition of being Moser. Moser, the Hebrew word for Moser, is to turn over a Jewish individual to a non-Jewish court or government. And if you want to read about it more, it's in source 11 for yourselves later. What becomes clear, though, is that we had rabbis in the Talmud whose day jobs were finding Jewish criminals and passing them on to the Romans. How do we reconcile this contradiction between a prohibition of turning over Jews to Gentile authorities for crimes, and on the other hand, rabbis in the Talmud who do it, and like these are some of our greatest sages. So what is clearly kind of mentioned, what it comes out as a clear takeaway, is that there's a difference between a government that has a fair set of laws and a government, once again, kind of similar to the dina de malchut dina that we talked about when it comes to taxes, a government that judges arbitrarily, or maybe even worse, a government that judges Jews far more harshly than non-Jews. Mm-hmm. And also, there's a difference historically in an era where blood libel, for example, like the cases brought by Christians against Jews, turned into pogroms, right, in Europe for 800 years of Jewish history, right, where the possibility of passing someone over to a Gentile government could lead to unfair treatment not only of that Jew, but of the entire Jewish community surrounding, right? So that's one historical context, as opposed to when Jews live in a society where we are treated equally under the letter of the law. This always comes up from time to time. In the past 5-10 years, the most relevant example has been when sexual abuse was uncovered in different parts of the Orthodox community. There were significant cases in Australia, in one of the Jewish communities in Australia, where there were rabbis who had committed years and years of sexual abuse of minors, and no one had reported them. And when the Jewish community started uncovering it, there was actually opposition saying, you can't be Moser, or you can't pass someone off to the authorities, that's a prohibition. So I think the halachic approach, and certainly the modern Orthodox approach, is that Mesira doesn't apply, first of all, in an era where Jews cannot provide the adequate consequences ourselves and keep our society safe because we're not in a governmental position. Secondly, when the laws of the government are fair and equitable to everyone, then we do apply dina de malchut dina, but the law of the land is the law. And I personally think, and this is not me, I think Herschel Schachter wrote about this, many great rabbis in the modern Orthodox community, that you're not only is it not a prohibition, it's an obligation, probably a biblical obligation, for lo tamod al dam re'echa, not to stand aside while the blood of your fellow is being spilled. There's a Torah obligation to pass on any relevant information when there's any kind of criminal action being taken, but specifically when it has to do with the abuse of minors. So this has come up. I don't want to encourage you to look at these news articles online, but if you want to find more information, you can just search it later. Okay, and last but not least, I think this is another example. You can see what Rabbi Herschel Schachter wrote in an early article about the idea of Mesira. That's in source 15. But I think, again, you know, this thesis continuing to play itself out in different areas is that when it comes to Jews and the laws of the other, we have two directions that our halachic texts take us in. One is this desire to really honor the legal tradition that the Torah gives us, right? To take care of our own. But the other tradition is, especially in an era where there is equity for the Jews, we are obligated to follow the law of the land, to respect the law of the land. And in some circumstances, it's limited even to bring our criminal cases to the laws of the land to be adjudicated as well. And so I think, again, we have this kind of tug within our tradition that we want to maintain this particularity, right? This particularism that's beautiful, that we remain united as a Jewish people, but we also specifically, we also accept that there is value to the laws of the land beyond us. And on some level, we're even obligated to contribute to the society around us by following its laws, right? When you pay taxes, you get the benefits of the society that the taxes provide. And in an era where the taxes are equitable, we're absolutely obligated to follow those laws. I probably should listen to this more myself. If you're driving on the highway, you have to follow, you know, highway laws and speeding laws. We are, in generally speaking, unless there's a contradiction between Torah laws and the laws of the society around us, not only obligated begrudgingly, but we should look positively to the fact that we are partake in a society that treats us with respect, and that allows us to maintain our own laws as well. And so that kind of two-way street continues. And God willing, it should throughout all of our lifetimes. And great. But next time, Jews and the wisdom of the others. Are we allowed to study other sources? Any questions? Yeah, Richard.
So what standing do Jews have to criticize other forms of law that, for instance, condone stoning?
That condone stoning?
Yeah, or actually stone sinners. It's in our tradition, but we don't do it.
Right.
But it's stated in Torah.
Yeah.
And how do we handle the apparent conflict with judging others?
Well, so I guess you're referring to ideas like Sharia law, mm-hmm. Where there are laws that are practiced that don't seem equitable in our contemporary society. And you're pointing out the fact that there are laws that we don't practice now because we don't have a Sanhedrin that might feel similarly unequitable. I don't have a good answer to that.
I don't know this. I never read anything where it's come up.
Yeah.
But I would want to anticipate a rebuttal from someone who practices Sharia law to say, hey, wait a minute, your tradition says the same thing.
Yeah.
We say we don't do it anymore. Well, because you've fallen from the true way.
Yeah. Well, in fairness, the rabbis, right after the destruction of the temple, right before, decided no longer to practice corporal punishment. It was an internal decision, not an external decision. Maybe this is the answer, that there was a decision that without the holiness that emanated from the temple, and the fact that the Sanhedrin was located right next to, actually in the temple courtyard,
mm-hmm.
Which I think led to some assumption of the rabbis practicing with a divine inspiration. Without that, we internally decided not to practice these laws anymore, or not to practice corporal punishment anymore. But it's a good question.
But that decision to not do it has lawful status. The decision to not practice corporal punishment has a lawful status in Jewish law.
Yes. Yeah.
Therefore, our oral law has constrained the written law, and that we have to look at both to understand our legal system.
I think that's fair. Yeah. All right. Thanks, everyone, for coming.
Yeah.
Lila Toh, have a great night, and see you soon. Looking forward to everyone joining for the scholar residence this weekend as well with Rabbi Yonah Reis.